Hello, and welcome to Out of My Mind in Costa Rica, where we talk about all things related to post-traumatic stress and complex post-traumatic stress. This means the content of this podcast can be graphic. And if you suffer from PTSD or complex PTSD, keep in mind you could become triggered. If that happens, stop the podcast immediately and take care of yourself. You can always come back and listen later. I'm the guinea pig here, and it is my life I examine on Out of My Mind in Costa Rica. It is my hope that my trials and tribulations, successes and failures, will somehow compel you to examine your life and discover your gifts. Socrates exclaimed, "A life unexamined is a life not worth living." This is a call to action for all of us. As a clinical social worker, this was my trade. My vocation. From personal experience, I can tell you without a doubt that what you don't know can hurt you. My entire life, I have been compelled to support and encourage people to grow, to boldly look within and courageously examine their lives. Shine your light onto those dark spaces, and the solutions you seek will reveal themselves. Now sit down, relax, and listen to Out of My Mind in Costa Rica. Hello, and welcome to Out of My Mind in Costa Rica. I'm your host, Ray Erickson. Before I get started, I need to tell you something. The Navidades have arrived in Grupo Alto, Costa Rica. These are seasonal winds that hurl themselves out of the east every December. And boy, is it windy out there today. I'm telling you this because at times the wind is blowing so hard, it causes my metal roof to vibrate, and it sounds like a jackhammer. Hopefully, it will not be too much of a problem. With that said, let's begin. Today, I want to talk with you about life and how CPTSD has woven itself into the fibers of my day-to-day experiences. I think about this a lot, and I'm guessing those of you who are dealing with PTSD or CPTSD think a lot about it as well. Getting triggered and the damage it causes is always on my mind. Most of my triggers occur in the context of close and intimate relationships, a primary relationship, like my wife. Conflicts with others rarely result in getting triggered. Triggers take an otherwise perfectly fine situation and turn it into a battleground, where I am emotionally out of control and dysregulated. This means I need to be prepared for moments when I get triggered. Although, right now, and for the near future, I am on my own, so the likelihood of being triggered is greatly reduced. Not having a significant other in my environment to play the role of antagonist helps me to feel safe. And I need to feel safe in order to get a handle on regulating my emotional response to distressful moments. With time, experience, and practice, I have gotten better at controlling my responses and reducing the likelihood of becoming triggered. I can only get better at responding to whatever life throws at me. It has taken decades to even get a handhold on my triggers, and I still don't have them completely under control. But as time goes on, I am less and less anxious about getting triggered and driving away the people I love. My amygdala never takes a day off. The anxiety is always just below the surface. I may look all calm, cool, and collected, but on the inside, I am vibrating. Literally. It takes a ton of energy to keep my affect congruent with what is actually going on around me. And it takes even more energy to conceal from others just how vulnerable I feel. It is a very sophisticated defense mechanism, starting in early childhood, and I fine-tuned it over the next 60-plus years. I wish I had this trigger thing down, but I just learned I had PTSD in 2014, and I learned I had CPTSD in 2019. So in some ways, I'm relatively new to being conscious of the conditions that I have lived with for the majority of my life. For me, life has a way of coming at you sideways, frontwards, backwards, and when you're least expecting it. Most people can maneuver through their particular maze relatively smoothly. They can accept and make use of interpersonal cues and societal rules in ways that benefit them. And they grow, and they become robust, and they bloom. However, people with PTSD or CPTSD enter their respective mazes as if a tiger awaits them around every turn, where they know from experience, at any moment, without warning and out of the blue, disaster will strike. We know without a doubt that the other shoe will drop. It always does. We just don't know when or where, so we become hypervigilant. Hypervigilance puts a tremendous strain on our operating systems. As a group, people with PTSD, CPTSD, and other anxiety disorders are prone to chronic health conditions like hypertension, irritable bowel syndrome, and my constant companion, acid reflux. On top of that, many of us with PTSD or CPTSD will do anything to reduce this anxiety, even when we have no idea anxiety is a problem. Throughout my life, I have used cannabis, alcohol, and other drugs in an unconscious effort to lower the anxiety I never knew I had. I just know I was stressed out nearly every day. This went on for decades. I didn't know I was seeking relief. I didn't know I was self-medicating. I thought I was having fun, which I was, most of the time. But this behavior has caused me plenty of trouble, too. So I try to be gentle with myself and move beyond any regret I may have for the stupid life decisions I made. I try to be kind to myself because I know that without these bonehead decisions, I would not be here today talking with you. I'm sitting here on a hillside overlooking the Central Valley of Costa Rica because of all the shit I have been through, not in spite of it. My mother would say, every cloud has a silver lining. So along with the bitter comes the sweet. Such is life. I can't explain it, but I know what it means for me. I don't know how, given the spider's nest I grew up in, but somehow I turned out to be optimistic about life. I try to live life as if my glass is half full, and I always try to see the positive in any situation. And my life has reflected this belief. There have been lots of ups and lots of downs, but mostly my life has been on an overall positive trend. Last week, I talked briefly about my legal problems in Idaho in the early 1980s, and I ended the story with my fourth arrest for DUI. What I did not share with you last time was the advice of my lawyer, who was also a patron of the Suds Tavern. He represented most of the DUI cases out of that bar. And the advice he doled out to me was this. Ray, I think it's a good idea for you to handle this case from out of state. I knew right away what he was suggesting. Get the fuck out of Idaho if I don't want to go to jail for at least a year. Naturally, the possibility of doing prison time did not appeal to me, so I took his advice to heart. Now what the fuck am I going to do? I knew he was right. I had to leave. It was not the first time I packed everything up and headed off in search of a brighter future, and it won't be my last. Idaho is a beautiful state, and the people there are friendly, like in the Midwest, but overall, there is way too much cowboy in the air for me. The U-Haul job I had would easily transfer to anywhere. It was fucking U-Haul, for crying out loud. I could go anywhere in the country and work for U-Haul. But that is not what I wanted to do. I was tired of wearing those baby shit brown uniforms. I was bored with answering the telephone, filling out forms, and smiling at everyone who walked through the door. I needed a change. A real change. But what the hell would that be? I thought about the first time I arrived in Idaho in 1975. My wife, Christine, and I were living in Michigan between teaching jobs, and we needed some adventure. So why not move to Idaho? I had an old high school chum who was living there. I built a plywood car top carrier and tied it down to our 1972 Chevy Vega station wagon. And we stuffed it to the gills with everything we owned and headed west with our sights set on Boise, Idaho. We were young, dumb, and madly in love. We were excited to embark on this grand journey. It was the biggest adventure of our young lives. About halfway through Nebraska, we began to scout the horizon above the endless plains of our nation's heartland, hoping to catch our first glimpse of the Rocky Mountains. Neither one of us had been beyond the tri-state area of Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio. Oh, wait, I did go to Washington, D.C. with my classmates on our senior trip. Most of that trip was spent sitting on a school bus for endless hours. I had never been so far from home. I remember it being hot, humid, and my feet hurting from all the walking around looking at monuments. Not a lot of fun for me. After all the monuments were seen, we said goodbye to D.C. and boarded that rickety old school bus and its uncomfortable seats where most of us slept for the better part of the journey home. Christine and I were somewhere in Wyoming when we first saw the Rocky Mountains presenting themselves as a thin ribbon at the edge of the horizon, where the heat waves coming off the pavement made it appear surreal, like a mirage. The closer we got, the bigger the mountains became, revealing themselves, their glory, and their splendor. After what seemed like forever, we began our ascent to the Continental Divide. Our little Chevy Vega managed well across the Great Plains, but when it came to climbing the I-80 corridor, the little Ford Banger really began to struggle. And even though we were crawling up the mountain at a snail's pace, we were not discouraged. A little nervous, perhaps, but hopeful and positive. Neither one of us had been close to anything like real mountains, and it didn't matter how slowly we trudged up that pass. This was a grand adventure. As the Vega churned and chugged its way slowly up the mountain, we stayed to the right and watched every kind of automobile, truck, and big rig imaginable pass us by. We may have been slow, but we were making progress, and it was not long before we reached the summit. There we were, standing at the Continental Divide at an altitude of 7,000 feet, with the Great Basin to the east and to the west, California, and the Pacific Ocean. We are relieved and grateful to be going downhill when the weather began to change. The wind howled and the snow began to fall and fall and fall. Before long, we were in whiteout conditions, slowly inching our way down the mountain. Luckily, growing up in Michigan provided a lot of practice in driving in snowy conditions, and we were not too concerned until we heard a loud thump underneath the car. We looked at each other and thinking the same thing, what the fuck was that? But there were no changes in how the car handled. We decided to forge ahead as opposed to stopping, getting out of the car in a fucking blizzard, and risking frostbite. As we continued down the winding four-lane highway, the snowfall lightened up and the driving conditions changed from a snow-covered freeway to an icy, slushy mess. This is when I noticed the gas gauge was showing a quarter tank of fuel. We should have at least three quarters of a tank. How the hell could this be happening? Then I remembered. That loud thump we heard about an hour ago must have punctured the gas tank, and we had been losing gasoline ever since then. This caused our anxiety to shoot through the roof. But our innocence and our youth kept our spirits high. Don't forget, I'm an optimist. I carefully minimized the use of the accelerator, unless it was absolutely necessary. And 20 minutes later, we hobbled into the tiny desert town of Wamsutta, Wyoming. We turned into the first service station we came upon, the Wamsutta Canoco. As the mechanic motioned us to drive into the garage, the engine sputtered, spurted, and then died. We couldn't believe it. We had made it off the mountain alive. Both of us exhaled a giant sigh of relief. This is where optimism pays off. While we ate lunch, the garage repaired the gas tank, and we were back on the road in a couple of hours. Our spirits could not have been higher. 4 hours later, we entered the Gem State, drove north for another 2 hours to Boise, where we settled into a nice little house on the north side, where we tried to set roots, but the roots never took. My second sojourn to Idaho in the early 1980s began with the end of my marriage to Christine and ended at the Suds Tavern after my fourth arrest for DUI. Even though Boise is a college town, the Suds Tavern was inhabited by working-class folks who carried their struggles on their shoulders along with a kind heart and a bottle of beer. Leaving Boise meant leaving this adopted family, although none of those relationships at the Suds could be called close. Nevertheless, it was still difficult for me emotionally to leave this group of people whom I had gotten to know over the past 4 years. Idaho, and the Suds in particular, had become a dark place, with several regulars committing suicide over the last 9 months. I needed to get away from this bar, far away. In order to do this, I needed a car. My 1972 VW Combi microbus was dead in the front of my tiny basement apartment located a few blocks from the Suds. The bus was undrivable and unsellable, so I abandoned it on the street. For the last 4 years, I drove that bus while under the influence, and as a result, I had turned it into a big pile of scrap metal, dead on the side of the road like a rotting carcass of roadkill. Fortunately, one of the Suds regulars, Cowboy Bill, sold me his 1969 Pontiac Bonneville for $900. I packed it to the gills with everything I owned and set out for California with $500 in my pocket. I moved to Sacramento not just to avoid going to jail. That was the main reason. I also moved to California with high hopes of getting into graduate school and becoming a social worker. It felt right for me. With a Master of Social Work, along with clinical licensure, I could go into private practice and not have to work for anyone. I could be autonomous. This became my new dream, my new quest. My decision to study social work stemmed from my experiences at a psychiatric hospital in Boise back in 1975. Intermountain Hospital of Boise needed a teacher, so I applied. They did not hire me as a teacher because I didn't have a multi-subject credential, but they offered me a job as a psychiatric technician. It turned out the PT job was perfect for me. My primary responsibility was to hang out with the teenage patients and be available to them if they wanted to talk. It was like I was getting paid to play. I loved the job, and I loved working with these kids who were hospitalized for up to 3 months or until their insurance coverage was exhausted. This practice was later exposed as an insurance scam by the private for-profit psychiatric hospitals. This experience of working with teenagers in a mental health setting revolutionized my perspective. I never realized I could work with teenagers outside of the education field. I fell in love with emotionally disturbed teens, and because of this experience, I decided to move to Sacramento and pursue a Master of Social Work degree at California State University, where I specialized in working with children and families. That provided me with the education and the clinical skills I needed to work with emotionally disturbed teens and their families. Meanwhile, the 1969 Bonneville I bought from Cowboy Bill powered its way through the Nevada desert. I felt lucky, so I stopped at the Circus Hotel and Casino in Reno, where I was not lucky, losing $90 of the $500 in my pocket. And deeply disturbed at myself, I kicked my butt for the remaining 90 miles of Sacramento, where I found a flea-bag downtown hotel to stay while I looked for a job and a permanent place to live. The next day, I called an ad in the Sacramento Bee to rent a room, and an old woman answered the phone. I explained to her why I was calling, and she told me I could move in right away because I was the first person to call. Imagine doing business that way today. She was a kind-hearted woman in her 80s and living alone, so she rented a couple of the bedrooms in her Fair Oaks home. The room was fine, and I had full use of the kitchen and the pool, and the rent was cheap. So I moved in and began to look for work. I focused on residential treatment facilities because I wanted to work with emotionally disturbed teenagers. It was not long before I landed a job at the Sacramento Children's Home. The Children's Home began as an orphanage over 100 years prior and was considered to be the creme de la creme of residential treatment for abused and abandoned children. It was a great place to get experience and training. I've always been fortunate in these ways. I've always found another place to live, and I've always been able to find a job. That could be, in part, because I've always pursued work in traditionally female-dominated professions, and these professions were eager to hire men. Because of this bias, I was never out of work for an extended period of time. Restaurants and schools were always interested in hiring males. So this is how I landed in California after doing everything in my power to fuck up my life in Idaho. Somehow, some way, I landed on my feet again. Like the phoenix, I rose from the ashes of disaster to be reborn again. Life sure does have a way of making its point. All of this insight is based on hindsight, of course. And time has eroded some of the sharp edges from these painful and traumatic experiences. But I am, and I have always been, fortunate. Regardless of the knucklehead decisions I make and the piles of shit I step in, this has been my pattern in life, and I would bet the future holds even more adventure for me. Hopefully, there will be fun adventures. Thus, my career in mental health was born out of the complete collapse of my own mental health. I am grateful that I acknowledged the mess I was in, and I was determined to correct my course. The changes I needed to make did not come easy. First, I had to fail again. I had to fail at finding another bar in Sacramento like the Suds, where I could set up my tent and move in. Fortunately, there was nothing like the Suds in Sacramento, so I was unable to replicate the drinking environment that existed in Idaho. Lucky me, because that was the one thing that kept me from going down the same path in California. I was now safe in Sacramento. I had a place to live, I had a job, and I was not going to jail. I pleaded no contest to my fourth DUI, paid a $350 fine, and was put on 6 months probation. Without a watering hole for me to fall into, this was easy to do. That is, until my girlfriend, whom I thought was still in Boise, showed up in Sacramento with our dog and moved into my bedroom. The presence of Diane and R.D., for Ray and Diane, was too much for the old woman. She knew we didn't have any money and gave us $500 to move out. With that money, we found a tiny duplex in a run-down part of Sacramento in a tiny run-down apartment complex with 8 single-story, one-bedroom duplexes. The price was right, and our dog would be okay. There was a fenced-in backyard which made it perfect for us. 1 month later, that kind-hearted old woman died. I didn't expect Diane to show up as soon as she did, but it was what it was, and I rolled with it. She got a job bartending, and I worked at the children's home and took prerequisite classes at Sacramento City College. We were happy, but CPTSD would have nothing to do with any happy feelings, and soon there was trouble in paradise. Leaving Idaho also meant leaving Diane, and our plan was for her to move to Sacramento eventually. Not a month later, though. But she did, and we settled into the duplex, which worked out really well for us as long as our relationship was working. But along with her and the dog came a few things I needed to escape from when I left Idaho. There was a lot of baggage to get over between Diane and I, and we quickly fell into old, destructive patterns of drinking and drugging. I knew I couldn't live like this if I wanted to turn my life around, and we agreed mutually to go our separate ways. There is much more to the saga of Diane and Ray and their amazing dog, R.D., but let's save that for another episode. So where was I? Oh, life. Life is what happens while you're busy making plans. I stayed at that little duplex throughout my graduate studies, graduating with a 3.88 GPA and my MSW degree in the spring of 1987. Moving to Sacramento kept me out of jail. Jail was not a good place for me, and I did not need to experience it to know that. The drunk tanks I occupied on four occasions during those dismal days in Idaho were enough for me. I now refer to this chapter of my life as the dark times. California worked out for me professionally. I was able to pursue everything I wanted to pursue as a social worker. I didn't know then I had CPTSD, and I'd had it for most of my life. I have been flying blind, not knowing of the sexual violence in my family, not knowing I had CPTSD, but for some reason, I chose to go into social work when I escaped the darkness in Idaho. I thought I chose social work because it was a very flexible degree, with a lot of opportunity in a wide range of settings. All of this attracted me to the field. But little did I know that social work had become the bridge between the person I pretended to be for survival and the person I really am, where I can thrive. For the next 30 years, I practiced social work, wrote a book for parents of teens, and lived a moderately successful life in Sacramento. That doesn't mean there wasn't turmoil. One does not escape turmoil when PTSD or CPTSD are in the picture, especially if you're not aware of or deny you have these problems. Like I said, I was flying blind and pretending to be a healthy human being. It was only a matter of time before that facade broke down. My intention with Out of My Mind in Costa Rica is to be a storyteller. The only truly valuable resources I have now are my experiences and the lessons I learned while on my own hero's journey. When I sit down to write, I start with an idea, an experience, or a memory. I never really know what twists and turns I will take. I just start writing and let the words flow. Then I go back and edit, and edit, and edit. For me, there is something organic about this process, and hopefully, after copious amounts of editing, I will end up with a product that not only interests you, but inspires you to take the next step, whatever it is. I approach the topics that Out of My Mind in Costa Rica this way because it allows me to access flow, a dissociated state of being where nothing exists besides me and my words. So that's what I do. I get what I get, for better or worse. But I hope the stories I tell about my life and living with CPTSD resonate with you and nudge you forward in your healing. I want you to keep on keeping on, because when you remain focused, resilient, and persevere for a better life, you are alive. As usual, I have given you some websites that I think will be helpful for your own healing and resurgence into the life that you've always wanted for yourself. It's there, and it's closer than you think. Be courageous. Be strong. Be kind. I'll catch you later. Bye.